Hello and welcome to the Anonymous Anthropologist Podcast. I'm your host, the Anonymous Anthropologist. I am a community college professor of anthropology with more than 14 years of experience in the classroom, and today I'm here to teach you something. Hello and welcome back to the podcast. I am L.W. Lucas Haston, the formerly anonymous anthropologist, now known as the transgender anthropologist, back with you today to talk a little bit more about what it means to be transgender. I was thinking of moving on today in this 17th podcast. Of course, it's only the second in the new 2015 series, but I was thinking of moving on and talking about something in politics or some kind of current events. But I looked back at the stats on my older podcasts, and I saw that by far the most popular one is podcast number 8, which is the beginning of the explanation of how intersexed individuals develop in utero. That is part of a lecture that I deliver as part of my class in biological anthropology that I teach at the community college. That podcast has by far the most hits. So I'm thinking that you guys are probably mostly interested in having me answer some questions that automatically come up whenever you hear that someone is transgender. So I'm going to do the best that I can to answer in a general way and share just a little bit about myself, but I'm sure you understand that I have to have a boundary somewhere as far as revealing information that's very personal. But if you know someone who is transgender, if you are the parent of someone who might be transgender, if you're the friend of someone who might be transgender, if you yourself are thinking that you might be transgender, then this is probably a good podcast to listen to, and it's a good one to tell other people about. So I'm going to try to answer today just a few of the first questions that I get hit with as soon as I tell people that I've finally figured out that I'm transgender. So the first question that some people get is, well, how do you know that you're transgender? I actually never get this question because I have been masculine for my entire life, and I have presented in such a masculine way that no one was surprised when I came out. However, there are some individuals assigned female at birth who, when they figure out that they are transgender, the people in their lives are pretty surprised by it because until that point, their presentation has been fairly feminine. That does happen. But I have always presented as extremely masculine, and so again, no one was surprised. I'll go ahead and answer the question anyway. So, how do you know you're transgender? As an anthropologist with a specialization in gender, I've actually had students ask me this question once in a while over the years, and only recently did I realize that it applies to myself. But I did have a pretty pat answer. Reflecting now, maybe it wasn't very accurate. For a long time, I believed that the main reason that I was not transgendered is because I did not respond happily when other people identified me as male. In other words, even though I dressed in a very masculine fashion and presented myself in a very masculine manner, when other people referred to me as Mr. or Sir, I was borderline offended. The people around me could never understand this reaction. I always thought that I was just another kind of woman, just a masculine woman, and that it didn't need any explanation or justification, but that I was so obviously female, especially once I opened my mouth to speak, that people should recognize it immediately. Probably the more accurate source of my discomfort was the misidentification in front of friends and family. Even though I gave very little in as far as the expectations of my parents might have been concerned, and presented always in a button-down shirt or polo shirt and jeans or slacks, I did expect to be read as female, and I did desire to be read as female. Again, I think I wanted to spare my parents, my family, the embarrassment. There were many occasions, however, when strangers referred to me as my parents' strapping young son. For example, if I was in a restaurant with family members and the waiter looked at me and referred to me as sir or mister, I wavered between correcting them or not. I didn't want it to be offensive to anyone. I didn't want to upset the waiter. But at the same time, I didn't want to just let it slide in front of family members. So sometimes I would gently and kindly and laughingly say, "Oh no, it's Miss. That's okay, and let them off the hook immediately. But the bottom line is I wanted to be identified as female, especially in front of other people. Why did it make me angry when people misidentified me? I only figured that out very recently, and now I know. It's because I resented the fact of having to make the correction, having to confess to them that I was actually in a female body. I mean, they saw the masculinity in me. They saw the maleness upon me. It was obvious to the world and to everyone around me. It was obvious to myself, but I felt compelled to deny it. And when it was shown to me like that, face to face, when someone assumed that I was male, I felt forced to confess that I was female, even though they were keying in to my deepest desire. And certainly that bred a lot of anger and resentment. When students would ask me, how do I know whether or not I'm transgendered, one of the first responses I gave them was this pat off the cuff remark. Typically, I would ask them, well, how do you feel when someone identifies you as a member of the opposite sex? And if they responded happily, I knew that was a pretty good clue that they might indeed be transgender. But if they said, no, I pretty much don't like it, then I said, well, then you're probably not transgender. You're probably pretty strongly identified in your birth sex. This, of course, turned out to be totally wrong when it came to me. So the truth is, I can't tell you, really, how anyone knows they're transgender. I can only tell you how I figured it out. All I know is there has always been a significant disconnect between my vision of myself and everyone else's. I have always perceived myself in my body, in my mind, in my spirit to be more male than female. I have always been aware of the fact of my biology and realistic about it, I think. But in my mind, in my brain, I have always been much more male-identified in body and in soul. I remember very clearly as a child receiving the strong message that I was a girl and that I should get used to it because it wasn't going to change. I come from a pragmatic family, and I think I am a very pragmatic person from childhood, really. My attitude was, I better just get used to this. But I never liked it. I never owned it. I never felt like it was me. I always had a problem thinking of myself as female, describing myself in the feminine. A very dear friend, a very long-standing friend, a friend since childhood, reminded me that when we were very young, preteens, I used to write stories and songs in which I changed our genders and made us all male. Couldn't believe it when she reminded me about it, but it's true. I always had a problem conceiving of myself in the feminine. I have a master's degree, but I've always longed for a PhD, and I think part of that was the desire to be called Dr. Haston, as opposed to having to be gendered one way or the other, Mr. or Ms. I get to call myself Professor Haston, but that's always felt a little aloof and elitist, so I don't really use it much. Now suddenly people are calling me Mr. Haston, and that's very new and very weird because it reminds me of my father, who's been gone now for a long time. I mean, it's a good memory, but I suppose it takes a little getting used to. So I myself have always been strongly male-identified. That doesn't mean that other female-to-male transgender individuals would say the same thing. I can't really speak for anyone else. Maybe the one really general thing I can say is that being transgender means that you feel really at odds with your own body. And because you're at odds with your own body, you're also at odds with the vision that society has of you in that body. So there's a biological disconnect, a mental disconnect, and then there's also a social disconnect between the gender role that is assigned to you and the one with which you feel more comfortable. If you are at peace with the body into which you were born, then you do not suffer from gender dysphoria. If there are things about your body that you would like to change, well, that's, I think, pretty normal. Many of us look at ourselves in the mirror with great scrutiny and think about the things we'd change if only we had the money or the will. But there's a very big difference between wanting to lose some weight or wanting to get rid of the bags under your eyes and wanting to have a completely different gender, a completely different biological sex. Looking at yourself in the mirror and hating what you see every day, top to bottom, is a very, very painful life. I realized with certainty that I am transgender when I accepted the truth of how miserable I was, trying for a whole lifetime to meet the expectations of society as opposed to the ones in my own head. So the doubters among you might ask, how is this any different from being totally psycho, from thinking that you are, for example, Jesus or Alexander the Great? Well, I really shouldn't have to answer that question, but obviously it's because those people actually are historical figures or biblical figures. They probably really existed and had lives of their own, and obviously it would defy the laws of physics and everything we know about existence to think that you could be a person who had already lived and died on this earth. So that makes absolutely no sense at all in any way that you look at it. Next, how is this different from thinking that you're black if you're a white person, or that you're white if you're a black person? Like that infamous case of Rachel Dolezal, that Caucasian woman who passed herself off as an African American. Well, identifying as black or African American means that you have a cultural, historical, and biological background as a member of an oppressed minority group in this country, that being the United States. For a Caucasian person to believe that they have the cultural and historical background of an African American is to be completely deluded. There can be nothing real behind that. It's the same answer that I would give to the question, how does thinking that you're a member of the opposite gender differ from thinking you are an elephant or a refrigerator? Well, of course, because those things are physically impossible. And if you did have it in your mind that you were an elephant or a refrigerator, well, then there would be something pretty dramatically wrong with your brain functioning. But to believe that you belong to a gender other than the one to which you were assigned is something that is actually physically possible in nature. The establishment of one's sex is something I covered again in podcast number 8 and also podcast number 9, where I talked about being intersexed. And that's a fact of biology. That's a fact of what your genitals look like. Being transgender has more to do with the image that you have of yourself in your brain as a male or female person. Many transgender people like myself will tell you that we've always identified as a member of the gender other than that to which we were assigned at birth. I was assigned female at birth, but I was shocked and horrified to learn that I was actually in a female body. That's a fact that made me unhappy for 49 years. Scientists are beginning to think that the development of one's gender identity has a lot to do with a fetus's development in the uterus. As I explained in those podcasts 8 and 9, the sexual development of a human child is determined by the hormones that are present during fetal development. But one's idea of oneself as it lives in one's brain and one's consciousness comes probably from a different place. It may well have something to do with the bath of hormones in which the brain is soaked during uterine development, and it may happen at a completely different time than the genital development does. Modern studies are showing pretty significant differences between male and female brains, and it seems so far, although I'm not 100% sure about the accuracy and reliability of the studies, but it does seem so far that transgender brains resemble those of the gender with which they identify more closely than those of the gender to which they were assigned. So in other words, me, as a transgender male, my brain might look more like that of a male in terms of its neural pathways than that of a female. These things are just in their infancy of scientific investigation, and I'm not ready to place a lot of stock in them yet, but as a transgender person, I do feel that my identity, my gender identity as it exists in my consciousness, has nothing to do with the physical development of my body throughout my lifetime. Okay, so enough with the academic stuff. You're probably thinking, when in the world is he going to get down to nuts and bolts? Well, okay. One of the first questions that always comes up is, which restroom am I using? And that's a really practical question. As a matter of fact, that question was one of the considerations that held me back for a little while in terms of accepting my transgender identity. When I first started talking to my wife about this idea that I might be transgendered, that I might need to make a transition, she was, very luckily for me, very, very accepting and wonderful about it. And that's not always the case. I know a lot of transgender people lose their partners in this process, but that may be a topic for another podcast. At any rate, she was, or at least she wanted to be, supportive in whatever my choices were. So when I said to her, you know, I think I really am transgendered, and the only question is whether or not I'm going to do anything about it, she looked at me and said, well, do you want to use the men's room? And, of course, I recoiled in disgust at the thought and said, oh, no, of course not. Of course not. I don't want to use the men's room. That's disgusting. And we let it rest right there. And seriously, for maybe 6 months, I thought to myself, well, that's it. I don't want to use the men's room, so I'm not going to transition. But then, of course, days went by, and I fell deeper into my depression. And eventually, I realized, you know what? Even men don't want to use the men's room. It's really true. I spoke to all the men in my life, and they all hate using public restrooms. So that was not going to be a legitimate reason for me to not transition. I struggled for a while. I really didn't want to use the men's room until I thought I really looked like a man. But then I discovered pretty early on that men don't really look at you when you walk into the men's room. Seriously, they just keep their eyes on the floor or on themselves, and they try really desperately not to make eye contact with any other men. It's actually pretty easy for a person in a female body to use a men's room because you just don't get examined the way women examine you in a women's room. Men's rooms always have a stall because obviously you might need to poop. And so you just go in and keep your head down and walk straight into the stall and close the door behind you and do what you need to do. And don't worry about what it sounds like when you sit down because lots of men sit to pee. That was a revelation to me. I actually have my nephew to thank for that information. He was very, very funny. My adult nephew, when I told him that I was transitioning and I expressed a little bit of discomfort about the men's room, he said, oh, don't worry about it. Lots of men sit to pee. And I was like, what do you mean? And he said, oh, this standing to pee thing, it's a scam. I'm really tired. I want to take a load off. I want to sit down. I thought that was great. So I just remember that all the time. And sure enough, having used the men's room now for a few months, I've noticed that plenty of men sit to pee. They're sitting in the stall next to me and you hear it. And it doesn't really sound any different than when women sit to pee, so nobody's going to notice it. And really, again, in the men's room, nobody is looking that hard or thinking that hard about anybody else in there. They just do their business and get out as fast as possible. So for those of you early in your transition, if you can pass at all, short hair, men's clothing, flat chest, you're probably totally safe in the men's room. Just keep your head down. You'll be fine. I actually had a problem using the women's room going back many years, maybe for my whole adult life. I've been chased out of many, many women's rooms because people think I'm a man, and then I've always had to kind of puff out my chest and demonstrate that I did in fact have breasts. So it's really a great relief to be able to just use a men's room and not worry about it anymore. And the other thing I will note is that they're not quite as dirty as you might think because having been to a lot of clubs and concerts, I can tell you that women's rooms get really, really disgusting. Men, you may not know this, but women's rooms get really, really disgusting, and the reason for that is because lots of women do not sit on the actual seat. They hover above it. They hover and squat above it. They miss their target because they're not used to doing that, and they hit the seat, and they splash, and then they do not clean up after themselves, and it is disgusting. It is truly disgusting. In fact, in my experience, I can say that men's rooms smell worse than women's rooms in general, but they're not really any more dirty, and there's definitely not any more pee on the seat. There's way more pee on the seat at a public women's room, actually. So there's that bit of information for you. Okay, next question. Some people, and they don't seem to fall into any particular category, but some people do ask me if I am going to have the surgery. It's a pretty funny joke in the trans community when we say the surgery, just imagine big air quotes around it. I saw one person joke online in a Reddit forum that he wanted to start a restaurant where the special would be called the surgery, and then the waiters could ask people, so will you be having the surgery? And I thought that was pretty funny because it is such a common question, and it's really nobody's business. It's like walking up to a straight man and saying, so were you born with a normal-sized penis? It's just not appropriate. No one has the right to ask you what's going on in your underwear. But I recognize you, my listeners, are curious, so I'm going to give you a little bitty rundown on what some of the surgical options actually are for transgender people, specifically for female-to-male transgender folks like myself. So you can divide this surgery into two different things. There is what is euphemistically referred to as top surgery, which involves dealing with the fact that you identify as male, but yet you have breasts. And then there is what is euphemistically referred to as bottom surgery, which deals with the dysphoria around your genitals. Let it be said that probably the vast majority of transgender people cannot afford to even consider any surgery. This means that FTM people resort to binding their breasts through all different ways, some really, really unhealthy, like using an ACE bandage. Don't do that. That cuts off your circulation and it changes the shape of your rib cage and it can eventually pierce your lungs. And I know I'm scaring you, but don't bind with an ACE bandage. It's not wise. There are lots of companies you can go online and buy a binder. Get yourself a chest binder if you need to bind your breasts. But that is what most FTM people do, is they wear some sort of compression garment to obscure the breasts with which they feel so uncomfortable, so unhappy, and so that they can move through life presenting as male. If you can afford it, or if you have medical coverage, then you can opt into a radical double mastectomy, which completely removes the superficial surface tissue. It's not a deeply invasive surgery. They don't really go inside and dig out everything. It's a very superficial surgery, and it just involves the removal of fatty tissue. And they sculpt for you a more masculine chest. There are lots of different ways to do this particular surgery, lots of different techniques. But the bottom line is that top surgery is the first thing that most female-to-male transgendered people will opt for if they can afford it or if they have coverage for it, because it's minimally invasive, not too tough to recover from. It's something you can really deal with. It's not that much different from an enlargement or a reduction. In fact, lots of FTM people have already had breast reductions by the time they go in for the double mastectomy. I think perhaps folks get the reduction as soon as they're able to because they are hoping they'll be happier with smaller breasts and then later discover that they really won't be happy with any breasts at all. More difficult to address is the issue of bottom dysphoria, which is the idea that transgender individuals have the wrong genitals. So a female-to-male transgender person like myself might feel very, very uncomfortable with their genitals. I'm not going to speak about myself here. That's a private issue. I can say that lots of transgender people are perfectly happy with their genitals. Lots of people are very unhappy. That varies tremendously from one person to the next. The surgery to address genital dysphoria is very, very complicated and very, very expensive, and it's also very invasive. Most people can't even think about paying for it. Some people are lucky enough to have the medical coverage to take care of it. Some people are lucky enough to have the finances to pay for it themselves, and if they do, then they have lots of different options. So there is no one bottom surgery. There are lots of different types of surgeries you can have. Some people just want their own organs to be as they are and so opt for no surgery at all. In fact, taking testosterone can indeed enlarge your clitoris and make it something that you really don't want a surgeon to touch. Some people will opt for something called a metoidioplasty, which frees that elongated clitoris to hang a little bit more freely from the body. Some people will have testicular implants. Some people may choose to have the vaginal opening sewn shut, and if you are truly identified as male, then that may be something that troubles you, although again, lots of transgender individuals are perfectly happy to keep that vaginal opening. Some even derive sexual pleasure from it. Some people have a hysterectomy. Sometimes that's medically necessary because of the male hormones that you're taking. And you can have any combination of these surgeries or any one of these surgeries. With a metoidioplasty, you will achieve what might be thought of as a micropenis. It's your own organ that has extended to probably two or three times its size just as a result of testosterone, and then freeing it from the surrounding skin gives it a little bit more appearance, I think, of length. Now, some people feel that they just can't be men without a penis. And again, that's a very individual judgment. I'm sure there are veterans who have come back from wars without genitals who are just as much men as any other man. And so I do not believe that one needs a penis to be a man. However, I do accept that many men do not feel complete without it. Therefore, some FTM individuals are compelled to seek a surgery which creates or constructs a phallus for them. There are lots of different ways to do this, but generally it involves removing a part of your skin and the fat underneath it from your forearm or perhaps your thigh, and then using that to construct a phallus, which is then attached to your groin. And the nerves that are in your clitoris, I think there are thousands of nerves in your clitoris, they're connected to this skin, and eventually you do have sensation. And so you can have a phallus constructed. It is a very, very complicated surgery. It usually takes at least two, if not three, different surgeries, and there are very, very commonly complications. But there are also, nowadays, some very satisfactory results if you can hang in there for the long term and wait a couple of years before it really looks healed and like a real part of you. I have a friend who just underwent this surgery. It's called a phalloplasty, and he had a phallus constructed from a flap in his forearm. That gap that was left in his forearm was filled with a single layer of skin from his thigh, so it looks like he has a great big rectangular burn on his thigh. And his arm looks really like a raw steak, although it will fill in, they say, within 5 to 8 years, a long time to wait. He will eventually have testicular implants and, I believe, a vaginectomy, which is where they sew the vaginal opening shut, and he will look and feel and present 100% as male, and I hope that in his heart he will feel complete. I am rooting for him. It is a lot to undergo. It is really an incredible struggle to make it through all of that surgery. He has an excellent chance of regaining very good sensation in his arm where the skin was removed, and he also has an excellent chance of gaining new sensation in his new phallus. It will take quite a long time before the nerves in his original organ hook up to the nerves in this new phallus, but they will hook up, most likely. It's not guaranteed, but it's a very, very good chance that they will hook up and he will have feeling. And many trans men have reported the ability to achieve orgasm through stimulation of this new phallus. So, again, I'm rooting for him. He should absolutely be able to urinate standing up through his new phallus. He had a procedure done called, I think, urethral lengthening, and I think that's also where a lot of the complications occur, but his chances for recovery are excellent, and so he should be able to urinate standing up using his new phallus. And of course, he will never ejaculate, that's for sure, but who needs that mess? And probably the only outstanding question is whether or not he will be able to get an erection. So the answer to that is yes, in terms of it being functional for penetrative sex, that is true. There are many, many ways to bring old Johnny to attention in order to complete the act of intercourse. It will obviously be through artificial means, some people have air pumps put in and you can use a little squeezy bulb to inflate them. And some people have adjustable, bendable rods inserted that you can use. And you can also use a little cage around the exterior to keep it erect. But as my friend often states, he is going to be a shower, not a grower. Because these newly constructed phalluses, they can't get bigger the way cis male penises do. They will not be small when flaccid and larger when aroused. They're just going to be one size. So many female-to-male transgender people who have the surgery will opt for a fairly large phallus so that they can use it for sex, which means that it's never really flaccid, so they have a rather substantial bulge in their pants. It's pretty interesting. My friend opted for, I believe, a 5-inch model, which is definitely within the range of reality, but it means that he will be walking around with a 5-inch semi-hard phallus in his pants at all times. He won't be the only one, this we know. I can't tell you where I'm going to end up in my own journey. Those kinds of decisions get made as the days go by and I find my life changing. I will tell you that I have already had the so-called top surgery, and I'm very, very happy that I did it. It's probably the best decision I've ever made about my own body. I feel so much more at home in it, so much more comfortable in it. And everyone around me agrees that it looks very natural and it makes complete sense. It's not as if I ever showed anyone that I had breasts. I did everything I could to obscure them my whole life. So it works for me, and I'm very, very happy about it. I have no idea where my road will lead as far as any further surgery is concerned. I'm a very long way from even thinking about it because I'm very, very early in my journey. Well, seeing as I've used up about a half an hour of your time here, we'll call an end to this particular episode. I'd like to invite you to write into me with your questions, if you have any. And probably the best way to do that is to send an email to me at theanonymousanthropologist@gmail.com. Don't forget the V. It's theanonymousanthropologist@gmail.com. Next time, maybe I'll be able to answer some of those questions. In the meantime, I want to thank you for coming back to the podcast. I want to ask you to please spread the word about theanonymousanthropologist.com, about the blog and the podcast. Ask everybody to go back and listen to the old episodes because they really do lay the groundwork for who I am and what is to come. If I've got any of my old listeners back, I'd love to hear from you. If you have any questions or topics you'd like me to cover, I'm very, very happy to stop talking about issues of gender and sexuality. Then again, if there's more that you guys want to know, I'm happy to keep moving on in that direction. So once again, drop me a line at theanonymousanthropologist@gmail.com. I'm looking forward to hearing from you. Until then, take care.
Am I recording?